storms are this wonderful thing, right? That sometimes they're fun and sometimes they're terrifying. And they're mostly terrifying if they're if we feel out of control, right? I mean, we don't mind the little storms that pop up and come along, but then there are some of those storms we back up going, whoa, that was bigger than I thought. Like the hurricanes coming, and you kind of figure out, is this big, little? If it's big, do I run away? If it's small, can I stay? But in the end, the whole issue of storms is being out of control. It's when we think this thing is going to be so big and we don't know how bad it's going to be and we don't know for sure how long it's going to last. We don't know if it's coming over our house. And so those are the kind of storms that make us incredibly nervous, make some of us incredibly nervous. And so this morning we're going to talk about storms. Not just the physical storms, one of those for sure, but also all the other storms of life. All those things that unsettle us. You know, and it's all across the body this morning, a bunch of us are in storms. Maybe all of us are in storms. It's that stuff that's got, you know, it's all bubbling up inside and there's all this stuff going on. It feels a little bit out of control. It feels a little bit unsafe. You don't know where you are in the storm. Are you at the beginning, at the end, in the middle? Is it only going to get worse? Is it starting to ramp down? If God would just tell you how long the storm is, you can make a plan to get through it, but you don't know. And so we're going to talk about storms. Inside, outside, personal, family, all that kind of good stuff. Emerson on your outline says this. He says, the wise man in the storm prays to God, not for safety from danger, but from deliverance from fear. Because fear is the ultimate issue. And this morning as we talk about storms and how to navigate these things, there are really three themes that are woven through the passage we're going to look at. There's the storm, that's the first major component, but after the storm, it's the two responses of either fear or faith. Right? It's fear or faith. They don't coexist well. And we respond one way or the other whenever the storms are coming. So fear is bad, faith good. So that's kind of what we're after. And so this morning, as we're looking at four different stories, four different stormy stories, and all of them raise the same two questions. The first question they raise comes from Jesus' lips, and it's, where is your faith? That's the question that comes up in the middle of the storm. Where is your faith? And what Jesus is really asking is pretty straightforward, and it's, do you trust me? Do you trust me in the middle of the storm? Do you trust me when the storm winds blow and the weather is bad? Do you trust me, or is it only when the weather is perfect? The second question gets asked, it's off the lips of the disciples, and it's the question, who is this man? Who is this guy? I mean, that's the ultimate question of the Gospel of Luke, and he raises it over and over and over again in a variety of ways. A couple of weeks ago, it was John the Baptist saying, are you the guy? Who are you really? Today, it's the disciples. Another week or two, it'll be Jesus actually asking the question. It's the question over and over again, who are you? Who is this guy? And it's the ultimate question of life, obviously, but as we see Jesus move through these stormy situations, there is this part of it that has to take a step back going, wait a minute, who is that that is able to do these things? Because these storms, ultimately, they reveal who we are and what we believe, okay? I mean, that's what storms do. They surface up inside of us who we really are, what do we really believe, how do we really live, what are the lies and all these stuff. It all comes to the surface through the storms. And it raises the question, what do I really, down in the core of my being, believe about God? And it's in the storm that we do our greatest wrestling. And it's in the storm that our faith is forged and strengthened. All right? So we're going to look at, you can see them on your outline. There's actually four stories within 3 points and that kind of stuff. So we'll try to move through this in a relatively orderly fashion here. So the first thing we do is facing external storms, and we see that Jesus calms a storm, all right? So Luke chapter 8, you got that in front of you, Luke chapter 8, verse 22, it starts this way. It just says, one day, just another day, we don't know what day, just one day, Jesus said to his disciples, let us go over to the other side of the lake. So they got into a boat and set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. It's one of the most purely human moments in the life of Jesus that we see. Evidently, he's exhausted from the ministry, gets into the boat, and falls asleep. It's beautiful. And then it says that a squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped, and they were in great danger. Great danger. you know, Sea of Galilee, just little, it's about 5 miles wide. It's a bowl, and the weather temperatures and all this kind of stuff will cause the hot air, the cold air to collide, and these storms will blow up in a moment's notice. And the next thing you know, you got 20-foot waves out in the middle of this lake. And so that happened a lot. There's a couple of fishermen, 3 or 4 fishermen in the group, in the 16-foot long boat. We assume they kind of know what to do, but the rest of them are a bunch of landlubbers. They don't know what to do, and suddenly panic runs across. Now, I don't know about you. Are you like this? When you panic, how do you do when the people around you are not panicking with you? Right? You know what I'm talking about? You're in panic, and the person next to you is kind of going, no big deal. Right? I mean, do you suddenly go, do you glom off of them going, let me have your peace? I feel calmer because you're calm. Or do you look at them saying, what is your problem? Panic with me. Right? And I feel better when everybody's freaking out. So, and evidently that's the case. These guys are freaking out. Verse 24, the disciples went to Jesus, who's asleep in the boat, and woke him up saying, Master, Master, we're going to drown. Not the storm is bad. Not, hey, we're a little nervous. Pathological to the absolute worst thing that could possibly happen. We're going to die. Right? I mean, that's because that's what we tend to do. In the middle of the storm, do you ever go, no, we immediately go, this is the worst thing ever. We'll all be dead. My family is ruined. I'll never have another job. It'll just be, pathological is what we do. And so Jesus gets up. Pretty straightforward story. He got up, rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided and all was calm. Fascinating. Same language he uses, by the way, when he exorcises demons. He rebukes it. You know, so there may be something else going on here. This may not be just a normal storm. Maybe this is, you know, a little bit more satanic, demonic thing going on here. But and then he turns around to the disciples, verse 25, and he says, where's your faith? Don't you trust me? Haven't you learned much about anything about me yet? Now, I don't think he's saying, hey, if you had enough faith, there would be no storms in your life. Some of us believe that. That's crazy talk. Some of us think that if I was a really good Christian, I had plenty of faith, nothing bad would ever happen to me. Well, no, that's not. And he's also not saying, hey, if you had enough faith, you could make the storm go away. That somehow if you would believe strong enough, all these things going on in your family and in your home and in your life, they would all dissipate. It really what he's saying, as the storm rages around you, do you trust me in the middle of this moment? That's really his question. And so he gets up, he says a word, it's all calm, and then it tells us at the end of verse 25, it says, in fear and amazement, they asked one another, who is this guy? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. This horrendous storm, he is greater than the storm, and it terrifies them. You know, and so, what was the first thing Jesus said in this passage? Take a look. Look back at verse 22. What is the first thing Jesus said? He said, let us go over to the other side of the lake. What did he not say? He did not say, let's go to the middle of a lake and drown. Right? That's not what he said. He didn't say, hey, I'm going to get you in the middle of the lake. I'm jumping ship. I'm walking home. Right? He didn't say that either. He never said, hey, I'm going to get you in the storm and I'm going to abandon you. He said, let's all together go to the other side of the lake. If you're going to fend off fear in the middle of the storm, the first thing you got to do is believe the full promises of God. Okay? The full promises of God. Words are not cheap and shallow for Jesus. Okay? If he says it, he meant it. And he means exactly and completely what he says. And if he says, I'm going to take you to the other side, he means I'm going to take you to the other side. And no storm, no matter how great it is going to derail that promise. Psalm 146:6 says that he is the one who keeps every promise forever. And so he says, what he's essentially saying is, didn't you hear what I said? What do you cling to in the middle of the storm? And it raises the question that if you're in a storm, or when you're in a storm, What promises of God do you hang on to? If I were to stop right now, if I were to grab each one of you and say, right now, grab a pen, and I want you to write down the top five promises you hang on to in the middle of the storm, what would you write down? Could you write five? Could you immediately go, okay, here are my top five, this is what I hang on to. See, the Bible is filled with these promises of what God is going to do in our lives, and if we don't have them, then we're lost. Charles Spurgeon used to always say that God has a promise for every situation. That right now, if you're in the middle of a situation, you kind of go, God, what's the promise for this? But if you don't have a repertoire, if you don't have a list of promises that you can draw from because you're not aware of them, then you're kind of you're in the storm and have no hope. It's the promises of God that bring peace. And so I want to encourage you, find five verses, find five, ten promises. Write them down in the front of your Bible. So when the storms rage, you open it up, you go, that's it. Underline them, highlight them, mark them, memorize them so that they are right here ready to go in the middle of the storm, because what Jesus says, he means. He'll take you to the other side. There's a second lesson in here that I think we need today, and it's this. It's a more difficult lesson, and it's that following Jesus can lead me into and out of storms. We don't like the first half of that very much. Our assumption is that Jesus will lead us out of the storm. If you're in a storm, Jesus will lead you out of. But it was the disciples following Jesus that ended up in the storm. And we tend to get the feeling that if you're where Jesus is, there will be no storms. But it was Jesus' idea. He's the one who said, hey, let's go out into the lake. Don't think for a minute he didn't have a clue what was going to happen out there. It was Jesus' idea to take the disciples into the storm. Why? Because storms reveal who we are and what we believe about God. And sometimes Jesus leads us into the storm so that he can grow us up. Untested trust is no trust at all. We know what we really believe only in the storm. And so Jesus takes him out there. There's the storm. He calms the storm that has him overwhelmed. And then they say, who is this guy? Who is he really? There's this external storm. Well, next thing we see is that Jesus faces internal storms. He deals with some personal storms, and he exorcises a demon from a guy. Take a look at verse 26. It says, they sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. And if I love this story. My imagination goes wild. I can just envision these guys pushing the boat up. They all jump out real dramatically. Land! Land! And they're down hugging and kissing the ground. Land! We've made it back, you know. And I can just imagine they're going crazy here. And so they're all like, oh, thank goodness that's over. Verse 27, when Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from town. And it just got weird again. And it's kind of like, hey, how you doing? Here comes this demon-possessed guy. And here, look at what it tells us. For a long time, and the language here is so simple. The way the Jews write is so just bland writing. But it says that for a long time, this man had not worn clothes. He's naked. Or lived in a house. He's filthy. But had lived in the tombs. Nothing good comes out of the cemetery. Right? Any movie with a cemetery, bad. And when he saw Jesus, he cried out, screaming, running at them, and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, what do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me. And so they pull up on the shore, thinking they're out of the fire. This guy comes screaming out of the top, at the top of his lungs, barely a wild, naked, dirty, bleeding, scarred guy with superhuman strength. And he's coming at him and they're trying to get back in the boat. Right? Let's go. It says 29, for Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him. And though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. I mean, this is a terrifying picture of what Satan wants to do to humanity. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And the guy says, "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And so there's this whole nightmare of turmoil, the turmoil, torment going on inside this guy. And they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss, a place of suffering and separation, a place of judgment. Verse 32, a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And the demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and he gave them permission. And when the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned, and hence was created deviled ham. Right? Right here. This is the moment. You'll use it. Don't act. That may be the only thing you actually remember from the day. I'm well aware of this. You're going to be driving around town looking for any Bible study on this story. So you got deviled ham. Got it right here, deviled ham. Because I stole it from somebody else at another Bible study. So, but nonetheless, I mean, so you got pig soup going on right here. So it's this whole mess. And Jesus, the demons had, you know, Jesus has ultimate control. You got this man who's terrifying. He sends the demons into the pigs. The pigs then commit suicide, essentially to escape this whole thing. And they drown in the water. Couple of thoughts. Number one, personal darkness can't be controlled. It can only be changed. This is critical. Personal darkness, the kind of torment that we grapple with, the issues that are within us, it can't be, we can't create enough self-control to keep that at bay. And too often we're like the people in the community who keep trying to chain this guy up to somehow control the darkness, to control the sickness, and it won't work. We don't need control. We need surgery. We don't need a strategy to somehow deal with this thing, right? We need to be transformed by this. There's no other way around it. And we can come up with all these strategies of count to 10 or whatever. We cannot manage our sin. If we try to, it'll destroy us. I was back in college. I went out to West Texas to work in the oil fields. I was going to get rich. In one summer, I was going to become completely rich. It was fascinating, my thinking in the moment. So I'm out there, and one day I'm in a truck, and I'm in the work truck. I'm sitting in the back seat with the other guys, and we're headed off to one rig to another rig or something, moving on. And the truck, I don't know, hit a pothole or a rut or something, and it severely bent the tie rod. And if you don't know what a tie rod is, it's a rod that ties, very creatively titled, the wheels together so they work in harmony. When you bend it, if you bend it enough, the wheel, and that's exactly what happened here, the right wheel was cocked out so far that every time you tried to drive, it would rip off to the right. And so our supervisor, the lead guy on the job, AJ was his name, he got in the front seat and tried to wrestle the steering wheel over to get it to go straight. And it was so bent, he had the other guy in the front seat, and they're literally hanging on for dear life to the steering wheel, trying to make the truck go straight to get us back to the place. And if they weakened for just one little moment, the steering wheel whipped back over and sent us back into the ditch. And real often, that's our strategy on all this stuff that's our personal darkness within, is that I'm going to somehow wrestle this beast to the ground in my own strength. You know, like if you're a rageaholic, you have this, you know, what you can look at all the strategies to kind of try to control your anger. Again, you can kind of learn to count to 10. You can walk away. You can yell serenity now, right? But you and the people around you know that in a moment of weakness, when you get tired, it could all erupt again. If you battle with binge eating, it's the same kind of deal. You can wrestle it over for a while, but then in that moment, it erupts. Pornography, people-pleasing, pride, all of those things are the same way. And just like in the story, you try everything. You try to chain it down. But if Jesus doesn't set you free, you're never completely free. And what's so encouraging about the story, And I know why the gospel writers included it, is that this is such an extreme case. What Luke is showing us is the worst possible scenario. We've got this crazy man running naked, living in the cemetery, breaking out of these bonds, and scarring himself, trying to kill himself. And as near as I can tell, none of you qualify for this. Right? Don't really see a lot. Of course, I wouldn't see you running naked. So that's anyway, but then, nonetheless, you can see this in. What Luke is trying to say is that if Jesus has the authority to calm this extreme storm in this man, he can take care of you. But the key is, like the guy, is it's the decision to come out of hiding and come to Jesus that makes all the difference. This man ran to meet Jesus. It was the right first move. And if you're going to experience Jesus' touch in your life, then you have to bring it out of hiding. All of that destructive stuff in your life loves the darkness. It loves to be hidden. What we don't want to do is bring it out into the public, into the light for anyone else to see. And so we try to hide it and we try to manage it in the dark. And we can't. Sooner or later, you've got to bring it to Jesus if you want him to deal with it. Because you can't do it in your own strength. The second thing I see from this story is this, is that your changed life will make some people uncomfortable. Okay? I mean, that's what gets weird in here. Look at verse 34. When those tending the pigs saw what happened, they ran away. Ran off and reported this in the town and the countryside. And the people, all the folks in the town and countryside, says all went out to see what had happened. And when they came, look at what, when they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out. What's he looking like now? Sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed, and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. What had happened? Jesus said a word. The demons went out, went into the pigs went into the water. And in verse 37, then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them, because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and he left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away saying, no, you can't come with me. You return home and tell how much God has done for you. So the man went away and told all over the town how much Jesus had done for him. But here's the crazy thing. The man is obviously grateful. The man is ready to follow Jesus anywhere. But the people are saying, you go away. We were okay with this crazy man, but you're unsafe. You would think it'd be just the opposite. You would think they'd be saying, gosh, we're thrilled. Thank you so much for bringing peace to our neighborhoods. Thank you that we don't have to go to bed at night listening to this man howling and screaming in the tombs. Thank you that we don't have to be afraid to let our kids out at night for what might happen. Thank you that we're no longer terrorized. But the truth is, they're not happy with the change. They're not happy with Jesus. They're not happy with this man. And men and women, I hate to tell you this, but as Jesus changes your lives, there will be people who are not happy. They would never say it publicly. They would never say it out loud, but they like you the way you are because they're used to that. And they still somehow think that they can control you, put you in a box, and everything's okay. But see, when you change, it changes them, and they don't want to change. You see it all the time. When an alcoholic gets his life cleaned up and Jesus steps in and sets him free, that there will be people in his life or her life who keep trying to push him back into that place because that's what they're comfortable with. Corinthians says that life change is the smell of death and it's the smell of life. And the more you change, the stronger the odor. And it will attract some and alienate others. So when Jesus reaches deep down in your soul and changes you, not everybody will dance. Some will snipe and nitpick and make cruel jokes, or every time you screw up just a little bit, they're going to remind you, hey, I thought you were a Christian. You do all this stuff to try to, because they're comfortable where you were. They don't want to change. All right. One more storm. It's these desperate storms. And really, it's two stories woven together. Jesus heals these two daughters. So look at verse 40. Now when Jesus returned, remember what just happened. Let's go, he gets in the boat, goes out in the middle, there's a storm, right? Gets to the other side, then there's the crazy man. And then he's going back to the other side. How does he get back? Anybody remember what it say? He got into the boat. He gets in the boat, pushes back out into the water. What is in the water? Hundreds of floating dead pigs. Right? And so now they're rowing their way across through this mass of dead pigs, which, by the way, are going to be washing up on the shoreline for weeks to come. I don't really know what to do with that. I just thought that was a fun thought. It's going to smell like crazy. You would think they would start asking questions. How did all the dead pigs get in the water? Well, Jesus, demons, better, Lord over all. Hey, let's follow him. I don't think that's the way it worked. Now, when Jesus returned, evidently the crowd welcomed him. They're waiting for him. They were all expecting him. It said they're all at the dock. Here he comes. And then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house. Why? Because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. Beautiful, poignant moment when Jesus gets out. This synagogue leader named Jairus comes racing up. He falls at his feet and he's begging, saying, oh, my daughter's dying. It would have been hard for Jairus to do this. Jairus is a synagogue leader. He's a church leader for the day, if you will. And Jesus is public enemy number one in the Jewish religious community about now. Jesus is turning everything upside down. All of the religious leaders have huge problems with. And it doesn't help me that Jesus is walking around calling them all hypocrites and manipulators and charlatans and fraud. Jesus is just not real popular in that community. And so here's a guy who's a leader in this community, one of the most prominent guys. He might be kind of like the equivalent of the head of the elder board or something like that. He's a guy who has it all together. He's probably somewhat wealthy. He's certainly well known in the community. He's important. He's influential. A man of dignity. And he's got this incredibly high position, but that position will not help him. His dignity and position won't help him with his daughter. And so he's on the horns of a dilemma here. Will he maintain his dignity, or will his desperation drive him to Jesus? Max Lucado says that a man reaches a point where his desperation is a notch above his dignity, and then he runs to Jesus. And here's his little girl, his princess, the sunshine of his life on her deathbed, and he can't fix it. And he swallows his pride, and he humbles himself, and he runs to this country preacher that none of his peers like. And he desperately falls at his feet, and he says, my little girl, my daughter, is dying. Please come help. And it says that Jesus went with him. And look at how the story develops now. It takes a turn. Into verse 42, it says, and Jesus on his way, as Jesus went on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. There's people everywhere. And they're just all in. And it says, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one can heal her. And she came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. You can see the picture. You can imagine in your minds what's going on. Jairus comes, he falls, he says, please come, please come. And Jesus says, yes. And Jairus is going with all the speed that he can go. He's walking as fast as is dignified, really. He wants to run. He wants to grab Jesus and say, let's just run. But it's not quite dignified. He's walking as fast as he can, trying to set a pace that moves Jesus quickly so they can get there in time. And he's trying desperately, and the crowd is all coming along. And then somewhere, no one sees it happen. A woman works her way up through the crowd. Now, she's unclean. She's ceremonially unclean. It's totally inappropriate, everything that she does here. And she works her way up and slides up behind and just reaches out and just touches the edge of Jesus' cloak. Not a huge touch, just one that no one would even notice around him. And these two folks are socially opposites. She's a woman. He's a man. She has no name. But Jairus has a name, and he's important. He's somebody. He's healthy. She's been bleeding for 12 years, it tells us. She's had this vaginal hemorrhage that would render her unclean in every capacity. She's poor. He's rich. You know, she's never gotten any better. And she comes up and touches the edge of his. And then in verse 45, Jesus stops. Who touched me? And again, you can see the picture. There's a huge crowd. They're all bumping in. They're all humping on. They're all just moving. The woman touches, and then Jesus stops. Everybody boom, 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 and runs into each other, right? Because there's no signal here. Everybody stops, and Jesus stops, and he says, "All right, who touched me?" And when they all denied it, and everybody, "No, not me, not me." They're all bumping up again. Wasn't me. Jesus says, Peter says, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." You see what he's saying? Really? I mean, that's really it. Really? Everybody's touching you. Get over it. Why are you hypersensitive and so touchy today? And Jesus stands his ground. I would imagine he turns and looks at the crowd. And he says, "Somebody touched me." Nobody answers. Everybody looks away. He says, "I know that the power has gone out from me. Something just happened. God just moved." And nobody steps forward until finally, after this long, awkward silence, verse 47, the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, she couldn't escape, there was no way to avoid this, came trembling and fell at his feet. And in the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. And then Jesus said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." Beautiful moment, tender moment. He says, go in peace. You're healed. And at this point, the story returns back to Jairus. And you can imagine what Jairus is doing. You know, Jairus is standing on the edge, shifting his feet, wanting to go but needing to stay, trying to figure out a way to hustle Jesus up. The hurried glances, looking home, looking back, checking his sundial to see what time, how long this is taking, all that kind of good stuff, right? Wanting to say something, but afraid of offending the very man that he needs. Thinking in his head, "Forget her. She's nobody. She's just a sick old woman. My daughter is dying." And at last it gets finished. They go on their way. Verse 49, while Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore." And you know Jairus' whole body just fell. Verse 50, it says, hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Don't let this storm cause you fear. Just believe, and she will be healed." Don't be afraid. Just believe. Don't let fear overwhelm you. Keep trusting me. Verse 51, when he arrived at the house of Jairus, he didn't let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. These are probably professional mourners. In that day, they would hire people who were really good at crying. Kind of a weird deal, I know, but they did. There were people in the community kind of going, "Well, you want a good crier? Well, she can cry." And they'd hire her. And she could get all slobbery and blubbery and wail really loud and maybe get a little stuff running. And, you know, it was that kind of thing where it just dripping all over. Jesus says, "Stop wailing. She is not dead, but asleep." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. They'd seen dead before, and this girl was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat, and her parents were astonished. But he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. A couple of final thoughts as we tie these things together. One of the things you pick up from all the stories is this: let the storm draw you to Jesus. That's what happens in every one of these storms. The disciples, the demon-possessed guy, Jairus, the woman, they all are drawn to Jesus. Because that's where the answers are. It was out of their fear. It was out of their desperation. It was out of all of those things, whatever the reason. And Jesus didn't shame anybody going, "Oh, that's not good," or "That's a bad reason," or "I know." He embraces them all. And there's something about the storms that make us want to pull in on ourselves and make us want to hide and to be alone. But what we must desperately do is fight that off and take it to Jesus. You know, it's fascinating in the story. Everybody falls at Jesus' feet but the disciples. The demon-possessed guy, Jesus' feet. Jairus, Jesus' feet. The woman, Jesus' feet. But the disciples, not. It's fascinating that the followers are the ones who do not fall at his feet. To fall at his feet is an act of humility. It's an act of weakness. It's an act of trust, saying, Jesus, you're my only hope. And I don't know what storm you're in this morning, but I guarantee most of you are in one. And there's probably something inside of you that is both drawn to Jesus and is tempted to pull away. Allow it to draw you to him, not to create a wall between you and him. And then fascinatingly, after the storm, Jesus has a unique calling for each one of us. You know, the oddity of the stories here is that the demon-possessed guy shows up and says, I want to follow you. Jesus, I want to go with you. And Jesus says, no. He says, you go home and tell these people all about it. Matter of fact, later in Scripture, you find out that Jesus goes into the area and a whole mess of people come to Christ, probably because the guy's been priming the pump. But then he raises this little girl from the dead and then looks at her parents and I assume the disciples and says, shh, don't tell anybody. Demon-possessed guy, you tell everybody. A resurrection, don't tell anybody. And I think tied up in here is this reality that Jesus has a unique ministry for every one of you guys. When you come through the storm, you have a story to tell. And some of you are going to be like the demon-possessed guy, and Jesus is going to say, tell it all. Some of you are going to be like the woman where he just says, basically, go live well. Let your life be a testimony. And to the parents, he says, keep it quiet. This is between me and you. And the only way you're going to know that, there's no rhyme or reason other than Jesus tells you. You listen to his call, right? And you answer with your life. That he has something unique for each one of you on the other side of that thing. You know, the only consistent characters in this story, the only people who show up in all of the stories are the disciples. I think we tend to focus in on each story like, you know, this is all about Jairus, or this is about the woman, or this about... But I think in the end, these stories are about the followers. They're about the disciples. They're about me and you. And in the end, I think what he's trying to say, is trying to stretch them and say, don't you trust me? Because the reality is your life and the lives of the people around you are a series of storms that God uses to stretch your trust in him. It's one storm after another, just like these guys. And in each one, Jesus is trying to teach you, to draw you, to grow you, to forge your faith so that you're able to say, I trust you more, I trust you more, I trust you more. See the question, who is this guy? The answer ultimately is he's the Lord over all. He's the Lord over the outside storms. He's the Lord over the inside storms. He's the Lord over the family storms like Jairus. He's the Lord over the personal storms like the woman. He's the Lord over the death storms and the disease storms and the natural storms and the career storms and the financial storms and every storm. He is the Lord over all of these storms. And it doesn't mean like in each one, we don't know how long that storm's going to last. We don't know exactly what he's going to do in the midst of it, but he's over all and we can trust him in the midst of the storms. What's your storm today? Why don't we take a minute? Why don't you just have a moment with the Lord and just talk to him about your storm? And maybe talk about why you're struggling to trust him or why it's easy to trust him. But take just a minute. Lord Jesus, I don't know why you allow storms into our lives and why each one is in our lives. And Lord, we can't answer some of those big questions, but we know that in the midst of the storm, you're with us and that there's not a storm that will ever separate us from your love. that there's not a storm that will ever, there's not a storm that will prevent you from getting us to the other side or finishing the work you're doing in our lives. Lord, fear is rampant. And it wants to crowd out our faith. And I pray for myself and for my friends that we would learn to trust you more in the midst of the storm. Lord, I pray these things in your name. Amen.